You ever just feel like you're drowning in information, but maybe missing that one key thing that just makes it all click?
Oh, absolutely. Like everyone else got the memo on how things really work.
Yeah. And that feeling, that search for clarity, is exactly what this deep dive is all about. We try to cut through all the noise.
Get to the heart of it, right? Using the sources we have to find those essential insights.
Exactly. So today we're diving into Robert Kiyosaki's Why A Students Work for C Students and Why B Students Work for the Government. I've got the PDF right here.
Okay. Kiyosaki, he definitely stirs things up.
He does. And our mission for you, the learner, is basically to pull out his core arguments,
Yeah.
about education, money, entrepreneurship, find the surprising bits, the useful takeaways, without it feeling like a lecture.
Sounds good. So where does he start us off in this one?
He kicks off with a story, the parable of the emperor's new clothes. Pretty well-known one.
Right, the weavers who claim they're making this magical invisible cloth.
Yeah, and only smart people can see it. So the emperor pretends he sees it. His advisors, they all pretend too. They're terrified of looking stupid or unfit for their jobs.
The whole town goes along with it, right? Nobody wants to be the one to admit they can't see anything.
Until that one kid blurts out.
But he hasn't got anything on.
Exactly. And suddenly the spell is broken. So Kiyosaki uses this.
Yeah.
How does he connect it?
Well, he links that fear, the fear of looking unfit and stupid, to how people approach the education system and maybe conventional financial advice.
Ah, so the idea is that maybe the system isn't actually preparing people for the real financial world, like the emperor being naked.
But everyone's afraid to say it or even question it.
Yeah, because questioning it might make you seem, I don't know, foolish or like you just don't get it, that reluctance to question things.
That's the core, isn't it? That fear can keep us trapped in a system, even if deep down we suspect it's not quite right. It's a powerful barrier.
And this connects to his view on the American dream.
Right. He argues this fear, this conformity, is sort of killing the American dream, which for him is really about entrepreneurship, innovation, taking risks.
And he feels the traditional school system doesn't really encourage that.
He argues it's almost the opposite. He says schools primarily churn out A students, the academics, the future professionals, and B
B for
students.
bureaucrats.
That's his term, yeah. People who work well within large systems, government, corporations, but the C
The
students.
ones who might not excel academically but have that entrepreneurial spark.
Those are the ones he calls the capitalists, the entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
And he believes the system often neglects or even discourages them.
He mentions a kind of negative attitude towards capitalists sometimes. He uses survey data.
Yeah, he points to a 2008 Kauffman Foundation survey. It showed this weird split. People apparently respected entrepreneurs, like the idea of someone starting their own thing,
Right.
but they really dislike CEOs of big companies. There's this like real anger there.
Okay, so respect for the little guy starting out, but suspicion of the big boss.
Exactly. And he uses the Hostess Brands bankruptcy back in 2012 as a case study.
Oh, yeah, the Twinkie crisis. I remember that.
Right, but it was much more serious than just snack cakes. You
Yeah.
had, what, over 18,000 people lose their jobs?
Wow, that's huge. Families, communities.
Huge impact. And what really fueled the public outrage, Kiyosaki points out, was that the CEO and other top execs got these massive severance packages, millions, while the company was collapsing and workers were losing everything.
Oof. Yeah, I can see how that would create resentment. It looks like the system is rigged.
Precisely. And Kiyosaki uses this to ask a pretty pointed question.
Which is.
Is this what our business schools teach? He's implying, maybe they're teaching people how to climb the corporate ladder, how to be those executives, rather than fostering true entrepreneurial spirit with maybe a broader sense of responsibility.
Okay, which leads him to distinguish between those CEOs and what he calls true capitalists. That was an interesting distinction.
Yeah, he breaks it down. He sees most CEOs, even highly paid ones, as managerial capitalists. They're essentially employees, very skilled, very important, but still employees managing someone else's business.
Like a hired gun, almost.
Sort of. They don't necessarily have the same level of personal financial risk, the same skin in the game, as the person who actually founded the company or took the initial massive
The
risk.
true capitalist, in his view.
Right. He gives examples like Steve Jobs, Thomas Edison, Walt Disney, Mark Zuckerberg, and he makes a point.
But some of them weren't exactly top students.
Exactly. Jobs and Zuckerberg dropped out of college. Edison and Disney didn't even finish high school. His argument is that these figures, his C students, are the real drivers of innovation and wealth creation.
While the A students often end up working for them, or becoming those managerial types.
That's his thesis, and it loops back to the emperor's new clothes. Well, the A student CEO might have all the qualifications, the degrees, the accolades, but maybe they lack that fundamental gut-level understanding of how money and business really work outside the textbook. They might look the part, but are they financially naked in some ways?
Interesting. So this perceived gap in understanding, he sees it as part of a bigger problem, an educational crisis.
Yes. And he talks about this concept of lag time in the education industry. It's pretty shocking.
How long does he say it is?
50 years. 50. He compares it to other industries like the auto industry, maybe 25 years, government 35, construction even longer at 60.
50 years for education to adapt. Why so slow, in his opinion?
He suggests a couple of things. One, the system itself is resistant to admitting potential failures, like we talked about with the Emperor parable, fear of accountability. And the other, he points to the strong presence of labor unions in these sectors, with long lag times, education, auto, government, construction. He suggests these structures, maybe rooted in the industrial age, can make rapid adaptation difficult in today's faster-paced information age.
So the result is students graduating without the financial know-how they need, graduating naked.
That's his term, unprepared for the financial realities. And he uses a real-world example from politics to highlight this lack of financial literacy.
Which one?
The 2012 Obama versus Romney presidential campaign, specifically the discussion around their taxes.
I remember that being a big topic. What was Kiyosaki's angle?
He highlighted the difference in their reported tax rates. Obama paid about 20.5% on an income of around $3 million. Romney paid about 14% on a much higher income, something like $21 million.
Okay, so Romney paid a lower percentage despite earning much more.
Right, and Kiyosaki's observation wasn't about whether that was fair or unfair, but about the reaction. He says most people just got angry. They demanded higher taxes on the rich.
Instead of asking how Romney managed that lower rate legally.
Exactly. Instead of getting curious about the financial strategies involved, the different types of income, the tax code, the reaction was primarily emotional. Anger rather than education.
Which ties into his broader point about financial literacy.
Precisely. He frames it like this. Obama's approach, focusing on taxing the rich more, was like giving kids fish. Kiyosaki argues we should be teaching kids to fish, empowering everyone with the financial knowledge to succeed.
That makes sense. And this leads us into some of his more, let's say, controversial statements.
Definitely. He's known for challenging conventional wisdom, like his famous line from Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Your house is not an asset. That one definitely caused a stir.
It did. And he still stands by it. He points to the 2007 housing crash as, well, pretty brutal proof that a house can absolutely become a liability, costing you money instead of making you money.
Okay, fair point. After 2008, what about the other big one? Savers or losers?
Yeah, that's another one that rankles people. His logic there is tied to monetary policy. He argues that with central banks constantly printing more money, combined with low interest rates and inevitable inflation, just letting your cash sit in a savings account means its actual purchasing power is steadily eroding over time.
So the money loses value even if the number stays the same or grows slightly with interest.
That's the idea. He often uses gold as an example. Look how much the price of gold has gone up since, say, the early 2000s. He sees that as evidence that fiat currency, saved cash, is losing ground.
Okay, so he's challenging these core financial assumptions. To help people navigate this, he introduces his own framework, right? The cash A flow quadrant?
Yes, the cash A flow quadrant. It's fundamental to his teaching. He divides income earners into four categories based on how they make their money.
Let's break it down. What are the four?
You've got E, S, B, and I.
Okay. E is four.
Employee, someone who works for a paycheck, has a job.
Standard employment. Got it.
S. S stands for small business owner or self-employed. Think doctors, lawyers with their own practice, shop owners, freelancers, people who own their job, essentially.
Right. So E and S are the most common paths.
He argues that's what the traditional school system primarily prepares people for, the left side of the quadrant.
Okay, so what's on the right side? B.
B is for big business owner, typically someone who owns a system and has people working for them. He often uses the benchmark of 500 plus employees. The business runs without their direct day-to-day involvement being essential.
And I.
I is for investor, someone whose money works for them. They invest in assets like real estate, stocks, businesses that generate income.
So ESBI, employee, self-employed, big business investor. Why is this distinction so important for him?
Because, he argues, your quadrant dramatically affects not just how you earn, but crucially how you're taxed and your potential for building significant wealth.
Ah, the tax angle again.
Absolutely. He explains there are different kinds of income. Ordinary income, like your salary from an E quadrant job, is generally taxed at the highest rates.
Okay, what other kinds are there?
Portfolio income, think capital gains from selling stocks or bonds. And passive income, typically from businesses you own but don't actively manage day to day, or rental real estate. These often have more favorable tax treatment.
So understanding which quadrant you're in and which you want to be in helps you understand the tax implications.
Precisely. His point isn't necessarily that tax avoidance should be your only goal, but that understanding these basic tax principles early helps you make smarter life decisions about your career, your investments, which quadrant to aim for.
It makes more sense now why he suggests just shouting, "Tax the rich," might not always work as intended.
Right, because people operating primarily in the BNI quadrants often have legal structures and strategies available to them, encouraged by the tax code, in many cases to minimize their tax burden compared to someone earning the same amount as an E or S.
They're playing a different game with different rules.
In many ways, yes. And this leads Kiyosaki to express concern about what he calls the entitlement mentality.
Okay, what does he mean by that exactly?
He sees it as a mindset where people expect the government or society to provide for their needs and security rather than taking personal responsibility for their own financial future.
And he gives examples.
Yeah, he points to things like the projected shortfall in Social Security, the idea I might be bankrupt by what, 2033 or so. He talks about the massive challenges of an aging population, housing, healthcare costs, Medicare. He calls that the biggest gorilla, a huge unfunded liability.
So relying on these systems might be risky.
That's his concern. He also makes this quite sobering point about age itself. In the agrarian or industrial ages, age and experience were often assets, but in the fast-changing information age.
Could age become a liability if you haven't adapted or built financial independence?
That's the uncomfortable question he raises. He also connects entitlement to the ballooning national debt, predicting the inevitability of higher taxes and inflation, which he calls a hidden tax.
He even goes into the history of tax withholding.
Right, how it started in the U.S. during World War II as a patriotic measure. But he questions if that original intent still fully applies today. He talks about pork barrel spending as a kind of welfare for the rich or connected.
And he brings up Romney's 47% comment from that 2012 campaign again.
Yes, using it and contrasting tax burdens of the top 1% versus the bottom 50%, not to take a political side, but to illustrate the complexity and the emotional charge around taxes. His underlying message is always get financially educated, don't just react emotionally.
He links this entitlement idea to psychology too, right? Maslow.
Yeah, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. He suggests the entitlement mentality often stems from being stuck at the safety level, craving security and stability, maybe looking to external sources like the government to provide it, rather than building it internally through financial competence.
So the antidote to entitlement, in his view, is proactive financial education.
Exactly. And he emphasizes that this education ideally starts very early and primarily.
With parents.
Yes, parents as the first and most important financial teachers. He even talks about these windows of learning.
Ah, yeah, that was interesting. Can you recap those?
He breaks it down roughly by age. Birth to 12 is what he calls quantum learning, kids absorbing information like sponges. Then 12 to 24 is rebellious learning, maybe questioning authority, needing different approaches. And 24 to 36 is professional learning focused on career skills.
And he believes you can tailor financial lessons to these different stages.
Absolutely. And he's a huge advocate for experiential learning, especially games,
Like Monopoly.
monopolies, and of course, his own cash flow game. He often says he learned more about money playing Monopoly as a kid than he did in school. It makes abstract concepts tangible.
And he has that line about his banker.
Right. My banker never asked for my report card, he asked for my financial statement. His point is that in the real world of money, your financial statement is your report card.
So understanding that statement, income, expenses, assets, liabilities, is crucial. Learning the language of money.
Exactly. Learn the language early. And he distinguishes between financial advice, someone telling you what specific product to buy, and financial education.
What's the difference there?
Advice is tell me what to do. Education is tell me what to study so I can decide what to do. He warns against blindly trusting advisors or just dumping money into standard employee retirement plans without understanding them. He even echoes some critiques, like John Bogle's, about high fees in things like mutual funds.
It's about taking ownership of your financial knowledge.
Precisely. And he broadens the idea of intelligence beyond just academics.
Right. He mentions Howard Gardner's multiple intelligences, but focuses on a couple.
He acknowledges things like logical, mathematical, or bodily kinesthetic intelligence, but he really emphasizes intrapersonal intelligence.
Reaches.
Basically self-awareness, emotional intelligence, resilience, the ability to manage your own fears and greed, persevere through setbacks, what he sometimes calls success intelligence.
That internal strength seems key to his philosophy. He also talks about seeing things from multiple angles.
Yeah, the three sides to every coin idea, heads, tails, and the edge.
The edge.
Meaning there's usually more than just two opposing viewpoints. He stresses the importance of seeing nuance, multiple perspectives. He contrasts this with school, which often teaches one right answer, a linear path. Life, he says, is more like navigating waves, constantly making course corrections.
He uses the Apollo 11 mission as an analogy.
Right, how it was actually off course most of the time, but constantly adjusting to reach the moon. Life and business are like that, not a straight line.
And central to navigating those waves is understanding his definitions of assets and liabilities. Mm. Can we revisit those? Super simple, but powerful.
Absolutely core. An asset, in his definition, puts money in your pocket consistently. A liability takes money out of your pocket consistently.
Regardless of what conventional accounting might call it.
Exactly. Your house might be called an asset on a balance sheet, but if the mortgage, taxes, insurance, and upkeep consistently drain your cash flow more than any appreciation or rent would provide, he calls it a liability in practice. He even criticized how, during the 2008 crisis with the TARP bailouts, leaders were calling toxic debts assets.
Okay, so understanding that distinction helps you build the right kind of financial statement. He talks about different financial classes based on these statements.
Yeah, broadly, he outlines three. The working poor, whose expenses tend to match or exceed income, with few assets and often bad debt. The middle class, who might have higher incomes but also higher expenses and often acquire liabilities they think are assets, like the expensive house or car. And the rich.
Who focus on acquiring assets.
Exactly. Assets that generate passive or portfolio income, covering their expenses and allowing them to acquire more assets. Their financial statements look fundamentally different.
He also gets into some criticisms of government spending and bureaucracy again, doesn't he?
He does. He touches on potential government inefficiency, what he sometimes calls a self-service mentality in parts of the public sector, using examples like alleged excessive pension payouts in cities like Vernon, California, or the bankruptcy of San Bernardino, or financial issues in Phoenix.
Contrasting that with what he sees as true capitalism.
Right. The principle that the more people I serve effectively, the more successful I become. A focus on value creation, not just extraction.
He also weaves in some more history lessons,
mm.
connecting past decisions to present realities.
Yeah, he often brings up Nixon taking the U.S. dollar off the gold standard in 1971. He argues this shifted us to a debt standard, fueling inflation and making saving less attractive.
And opening trade with China.
He links that to the shift towards a more consumer-based economy in the West, potentially leading to stagnant wages for many as manufacturing moved overseas. These are big picture connections he draws.
And speaking of debt, he challenges the common idea that all debt is bad.
Huge point for him. He distinguishes between good debt and bad debt.
Bad debt is.
Debt used to buy liabilities or consumables. Credit card debt for vacations, car loans for depreciating vehicles, stuff that drains your pocket.
And good debt.
Debt used strategically to acquire assets that generate income, like borrowing money to buy a rental property that produces positive cash flow after expenses.
So using borrowed money to make more money.
Exactly. He explains how banks actually want debtors, how the system of fractional reserve banking works. They make money by lending money out. He shares his own stories of using debt, good debt, to build his real estate portfolio, sometimes achieving what he calls infinite returns once the debt is paid off by the rental income, but the asset still produces cash flow.
It's a completely different way of looking at borrowing, and taxes play into this too.
Big time. He argues the tax code often favors capitalists and investors. Why? Because the government wants certain activities to happen.
Like what?
Creating jobs, which B quadrant entrepreneurs do. Providing housing, which real estate investors do. Developing energy resources. So the tax code offers incentives, deductions, credits for these activities.
So the rich, particularly in the B and I quadrants, aren't just finding loopholes. They're often utilizing incentives deliberately put there.
That's his perspective. They understand the rules and play the game accordingly. The poor and middle class, often stuck in the E&S quadrants, view taxes primarily as a burden, while the rich in B&I often see taxes as a series of incentives to guide their actions.
So this financial education he champions, it really gives people an unfair advantage.
He uses that term, yes. Unfair in the sense that it equips you to earn more, keep more of what you earn, legally through understanding taxes, and protect your money more effectively. He believes this knowledge leads not just to wealth, but also potentially to greater generosity and peace of mind.
He even talks about a sort of graduate school for capitalists. What's that involve?
Learning to be the Fed in your own life.
Meaning, print your own money. Metaphorically speaking?
Metaphorically, yes. Learning to create assets, businesses, intellectual property, real estate portfolios that generate cash flow consistently, almost like having your own money printing machine. He uses his own rich dad company as an example of creating educational assets that produce income.
Wow. Okay, so wrapping this all up, the power really lies in starting that education journey, preferably at home.
That's the core takeaway. Using those tools, he suggests understanding the windows of learning, appreciating multiple intelligences, especially emotional resilience, using games like cash flow, understanding Maslow's hierarchy in a financial context, seeing multiple perspectives.
Creating a learning environment where mistakes are okay.
Crucial. Where mistakes are seen as learning opportunities, not failures. Where you learn the language of money, understand assets versus liabilities, and grasp the different rules of the cash flow quadrant.
So as we finish this deep dive, the fundamental message from Kiyosaki seems to be the critical, urgent need for financial education.
Absolutely. Starting at home, empowering yourself and the next generation to understand how money really works in the modern world, so you're not just playing the game, but understanding the rules and maybe even changing which quadrant you play in.
It really comes back to that core idea. It's often not about raw intelligence, but about financial intelligence, a different understanding of money and risk that explains why his A and B students might end up working for the C students.
Exactly. They've been taught differently, perhaps focused on earning income rather than building assets. So maybe a final thought for our listener to chew on.
Go for it.
Consider which side of the coin, or maybe just which part of the financial world you've primarily been taught to see. Are there other perspectives, like the ones Kiyosaki raises about assets, debt, taxes, the quadrants, that might empower your own financial future or the future of kids in your life?
Maybe exploring something like the cash flow game could be a practical next step to see those concepts in action.
Could be a great way to start.
Well, thanks for taking this deep dive with us today. We hope exploring Kiyosaki's often provocative ideas has given you some valuable food for thought.